Welcome to a special edition of the Traveling Hoopers podcast. I am your host, Alan Perry Jr., and the two gentlemen in front of you are my best friends in the world, Calvin McGowan and Philip McDixon. Wow. Philip Dixon. Guys, go ahead and let the people hear your voice.
What's up, everybody? I'm Calvin McGowan, as always. It's a pleasure to be here, and this one is going to be fun.
Hello, Philip Dixon, American historian. How you doing?
That's right. We got it.
That's right.
This is going to be really fun because you went to college for this nerdy type of stuff. So, guys.
I feel like there's like a 30%. I feel like there's like a 50% chance we go off the rails at least once.
Yeah. I say put that 30 up to a 65.
I was trying to be nice about it.
Okay, yeah, because this book and the subject matters involved in this book are inherently political. So obviously it's going to translate to broader topics of like society outside of sports. Oh, yeah. And I know from some of the notes that I took down that that's just bound to be the case. And I assume from you guys that might be the case as well.
Oh yeah, most definitely. So guys, the book that we're talking about is called, it's actually an unreleased copy. The beauty of being in the media and, you know, Philip, yeah, the beauty of being in media is you get to do really cool stuff with really cool people. And one of the first really big things that we get to do is review a book that's not even out yet. It's supposed to come out March 3rd. It's called Blackballed by Teresa Runstetter. And it basically gives the early history of the NBA. And by inclusion, it also talks about the ABA. And we basically go from pretty much the 1960s to modern day. And we're going to discuss part one of the book, which pretty much goes from the early 60s to about like 72.
Yeah.
So they kind of like the introduction kind of speed runs, I think, like the 40s and 50s.
Yeah. Which is very necessary.
Yeah. And so, well, I mean, like there was stuff we're talking about going on, but it's just not where we're focusing, right? The focus, right, late 60s, right through like the 70s.
Yeah. I'm just saying, when your league come out and there's no people with melanin in it for it, nobody cares, bro.
Yeah, but that's like every league of any sport. Before,
exactly.
I agree, you know, so.
I'm glad you said it so I didn't have to.
I mean, that's what I'm here for.
Okay.
Yeah, but this book hits the ground running as far as I'm concerned. The introduction is, well, like the first three pages, I got the attention span of a squirrel. These two guys in front of me, avid readers, they love long books about Marxism and whatnot, so they have the attention span to read stuff. I almost put the book down after the first three pages. I'm not gonna lie, when I got to page four, when they really started like dropping some names and knowledge, like what happened to Maurice Stokes, him like
right
poorly being taken care of and then leading to his death as like a 26 27 year old, completely shocked me. Why is that not a name that? Why is that a name that, as an NBA fan, that I just found out about in 2023?
Well, because it's early NBA and it's marketing. It is, you know, all these other things, right? So like, early like these major sports leagues that make millions of dollars for these people in revenue and advertisement. You're not gonna hear about the dark sides of these businesses, right? And that's how it is, right? And like, unless you actively go out of your way to do so, you won't hear about this kind of stuff. And the NBA had some of the worst stuff of all of them involved with it, right? But you know, this book is, you know, we're sticking to the introduction. This book is smartly written for many reasons.
Yes. Right?
So the first words in the introduction are, quote, NBA and cocaine, nothing to snort at.
Hilarious, by the way.
That is, but what does that do, though? That is inherently going to get your attention. Like, yeah, the first words of the book get your attention, and you're like, okay, what kind of ride am I in for, right? It sets the tone literally immediately. Not that this is, like, a part, like, you know, this is, like, the things, the subject matter that this book is delving into, and it automatically hit that, and I appreciated that, but, you know, that's off cover, just off basis induction. I thought that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, like, she, Teresa Brunsetter has crafted a really good book. Go ahead, Calvin.
Oh, no, like, she has done a wonderful job. I, granted, right, as of this particular taping, we've gone through, what, like, the first third of the book.
Yeah.
But it's, like y'all said, it is really good. She, particularly with the introduction, she does a good job of grabbing your attention of, right, vividly, like, painting a picture of kind of the what you're trying, what the book is trying to focus on, and a strong idea of the context within which a lot of the events that are being discussed in the book are talking about, right? So, you know, it mentions Stokes, right? It kind of speedruns talking about, you know, the NBA Players Association, right? And also just noticing, like, she briefly mentions her own observations of the kind of the tensions in play when it comes to race and sports, but, like, basketball and the NBA in particular.
Yeah.
And, like, right, she paints it as kind of the time period in which we the book focuses is kind of, you know, kind of a, in many ways, kind of a battle for the soul of, you know, the NBA, which, lofty expectations, which it kind of took a second, but I'm like, okay, I'm beginning to see it.
Yeah.
See, it's funny because for me, I initially, right, so just to give you the insight. So if you write, like, Black American, Black people, whatever, you use that terminology for, like, you know, the generational Black American, right, of the last 4 years, 5 years, mm-hmm. you capitalize the B, right? You capitalize the B because, like, if you were to talk about white people, right, of, like, in America, you don't capitalize the W because white people, you know, it is they are Italian, they are Greek, they are Irish, they are whatever it is, right? Like, the background of that said individual is known. But for Black people, it is systematically not known. So, like, that is what we are as a people, so you capitalize a B. But in, like, in terms of, like, historical scholarship, that is, like, a new thought process and a new way to go about things. So when you read a book talking about subjects of this matter and the B is capitalized, then you immediately know, okay, this person is in tune with the scholarship at the time. I was just looking at a book because I'm also reading 1619, right? I'm reading that book right now. And somebody showed me a book talking, like, kind of like a going against 1619 and, like, what it's doing. And in the book that he showed me, the B, it came out in 2001 and the B was lowercase. And I immediately was like, ah, this person's not up to date with their scholarship. So why should I, like, take that with a grain of salt? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So immediately open the book. I see this. I go, ah, okay, this person's, like, in tuned. And then on page 6, I was just looking at this. So I'm going to read a little bit real quick, if you don't mind. On page 6, it says, you know, By the late 1950s, the NBA was a league on the verge of racial and labor transformation. Elgin Baylor and the next generation of African-American pros arrived just as the civil rights movement was picking up steam, and they were no longer willing to suffer in silence while playing subordinate roles. And this leaned into, me and Calvin had a conversation when LeBron James was breaking the all-time scoring record of, you know, what is the greatest of all time and how to define the greatest of all time. And, you know, the context of individuals early on and the outside influences that are impacting their lives as they play this game, stress levels and, you know, what else they got going on in life and, you know, just health and so on and so forth. That stuff is also important to add on to legacy. In sports, not just basketball, right? There's a reason why people hold Muhammad Ali up there above Floyd Mayweather, even though Floyd Mayweather never lost. You know what I mean? Because he's outside influences and social aspects that linger in the legacies as well that add to it. And this book gets into that, like, vividly to a generation which many people don't know about. So it's like, were they weren't even good. Sure, how good would you be with people spitting at you, right? How good would you be in the scenarios we'll get to in the ABA, the early ABA days?
Yeah.
Right? Sure, right now when you're getting paid $1 million and you got personal chefs, I bet you'd be real good. But back then, your temper, your testament is really getting tested. Yeah. And this book really like leans into that heavily, and I really appreciate it.
And so,
this is really my only knock on the book, and I just kind of want to get it out because it's relatively small. But it would like it's not that big a deal for like me or Phil, but it might matter to people who have less context with these things. So something that I felt like I noticed, right, is that, so, right, our author is, you know, a professor at American University. She, right, is a scholar of African-American history. There, like, something I observed was that there's certain knowledge that, like, there's a certain amount of knowledge of the time that is kind of taken for granted.
What do you mean?
In the book. What I mean is, like, she will frequently reference, you know, like kind of offhandedly, like the Black movements of the time, or
right
how
the rights and stuff.
College students and athletes were also participating in,
right,
you know, a lot of the civil rights struggles of the time, but doesn't really elaborate, right? But she mentions that, and the reason I feel like the lack of elaboration is worth mentioning is that there are people who aren't going to know about all the stuff that's going on at the time, right? Particularly when she starts talking about like college students and athletes specifically.
Do you think, actually, let me word it this way. Do you think, because when you say that, this is what comes to mind. I wonder if I'm just like off-kiltered.
Okay.
It is a thing of like knowing your audience, because if you're reading this book, you probably have some kind of knowledge base of that. Since this book is like more specific, it's not just like basketball in the 70s, it's like more specific than that. So I wonder if that has something to do with it too.
And I also think because of how much background you would actually have to give, it would take away from the actual story that we're focusing on.
That's fair.
She mentions the Black Panther movement. She mentions specific like civil rights movement / characters. And I think we're going to get more into that when we get to the section that has more of a focus on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And I think we're very close after just closing off on the Oscar Robertson section, which we'll talk about soon, because that's the third chapter, and I think that might be the most powerful chapter of the three that is in the first third of this book. Let's get a little bit more specific. Let's start off with the first chapter, and it basically goes into the treatment of Connie Hawkins without giving too much story away. If you've heard the name Connie Hawkins, you probably know him as like a really big street ball player who just kind of has like these weird accolades, but you don't hear a lot about his professional career. And part of that is because he and four other players around his age, among with the many college basketball players at the time, were all implicated in a game fixing ring that was started off by, I didn't write down the guy's name because they, when you do heinous stuff like this, where you basically scrap 7 years of what is probably one of the generation's best basketball players, it's hard for me to want to remember who you are. But long story short, Connie Hawkins, young black man doing incredible things in his hometown. The dudes who fix the games come in there. They give him and the guys that he's with money, and they're not thinking about it because they're teenagers. And this tends to happen when wealthy white men see that you're a talented black person from the hood. They'll throw a couple dollars at you and on the back end, I hope that you'll look out for them. It just so happens that these dudes were a part of a gambling ring when sports betting was not legal. And them and Connie Hawkins just being attached to those guys took away seven years basically of his youth in prime, to the point where he actually got to the ABA. He was just still incredible, got MVP his first year. But he was more or less a shell of himself just because he hadn't played in so long. Guys, how would you like to... and then they talk about his struggle of getting into the NBA, being barred from the NBA for so long, and then getting attached with the ABA. What are some things that you guys took away from this chapter?
The only thing I knew about the ABA... Oh, that's a lie. Let me read the first thing. Most people, and it's true, most people, the only thing they know about the ABA is from the movie Semi-Pro.
Yep.
which is obviously a satirical aspect of like what the ABA was. But this book leans into at least the foundations of the starting of the ABA and why the ABA was a thing in the first place. Yeah. And that's a very important history because a lot of players came from ABA, but also if you understand like labor and like players' rights, if you don't understand it currently, then you should go back and read into the ABA-NBA kind of distinction. Mm-hmm. And talk about like the rights of players and like what players are and are not allowed to do, because it came from a lot worse conditions to where it is now. But to understand the conditions now and where they like originated from, this book kind of set a good foundation on where that was.
Most definitely. And I think a lot of it starts with Hawkins because of, well, all three of the main characters in this section of the book. Right. When we get to Spencer Haywood, when we get to Oscar Robertson, all of these guys are part of landmark cases that set the foundation for the NBA that we know today.
Right.
Like, and we'll get more into that. This is where the NBAPA is basically born. It's actually born like a couple years before. When I can't believe we missed this part from the introduction. I think it was about the boycott, the 1964 All-Star Game. That is another weird NBA fact that I feel like we should know. I know who Dave DeBuscher is, but I don't know that they was about to just be like, we're not playing.
Right.
Until you meet these pension rules, which they did not. At least not for a few years down the road, which is...
Yeah, I mean, once again, it goes into the fact that, and is this, I don't know if it's this time or the next chapter, I have to look, I took notes, but it talks about, like, business, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, the NBA is a business, so who are the product, who are the commodities? That is the players. Now, what do players, how can players take advantage of themselves? Or how can they just engage in that as well, in like in conjunction to like how the league or like the team's ownership organization, how they engage with the players? All that's very, very important. You know, you have the unions, you have the player associations, you know, all this kind of stuff for a reason, because it all stemmed from dumb situations like this.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly important history that, once again, like you mentioned, Alan, most people don't know about
at all. And as a person who's not a historian by any means, like I will, we've been doing this podcast for 5 years. For the first 4.5, I made it very obvious I do not care anything about the league before the 80s. There are players that are great that came out of that time, but I don't care about that era. That is a lost, bygone era. And I know I'm counting out a lot of really good, talented players. I did not know how important historically that time period is. And I'm glad that I got to learn through this book, because there's a lot of it's a lot of stuff in here, man. And unless you guys have anything else to add, I think we should get to the second chapter, which focuses on Spencer Haywood.
Okay. So I would just like to say that I'm admittedly not entirely sure. Like, I don't want to spoil things, but I'm not entirely sure how deep, you know, you can go. Right. But like you said, it's the 70s in particular, right, is kind of treated like a dead period.
Yeah.
When we talk about the league, right? Because people talk about, right, the 50s, 60s, like mainly like the 60s, right? The 80s, the 90s, now, like 2000s now. But you don't really hear about the 70s. It's kind of considered a dead era. And like what this book showcases is that's very much not the case. There's a lot of, it basically boils down to labor rights disputes. Related note that I only know about because this book, and it's not really a spoiler. The MLB is apparently exempt from antitrust laws.
Yeah.
And that's a thing for some reason.
I think that's the beauty of owning your own grassroots system or minor leagues. I think that's the only thing that saves them. But that should be the direct thing.
I think I looked it up. The justification was dumb. They made the argument that it wasn't. It was exempt from antitrust laws because what it was doing, right, was not, like, it wasn't, the judge claimed, and this was back in, like, the 20s, that the MLB was not engaged in interstate commerce. And because of that, they were exempt from antitrust laws and remain so, basically.
And I need y'all to hear that again for the time period, to let y'all know that this isn't specifically about race. This is, as far as I'm concerned, it stems from it being an economic issue. The people who have a lot of capital see the people who do not have a lot of capital,
right,
pretty much the same way. You can add race in there that makes it a little bit more strenuous, but I feel like that's when you get into tiers. Like, they truly, especially during that time, seemed like they thought they were above us, or anyone who did not have enough money to play the games that they had. Because in the 20s, that was pretty much an all Caucasian league. And they were like, y'all don't get nothing either. So,
right.
keep that in mind if you've listened this far and you think this is just strictly a race thing. It is a race thing, but there are layers to this.
I mean, people don't understand in terms of sports. People don't tend to know or understand that all sports, depending on the time and the era, are diverted up in terms of economics, right? Mm-hmm. Like this business, this transcends basketball. Basketball, most people, anybody can play basketball, right? Because it is a, you need a ball and you need, you know, like Damian Lillard had when he was growing up, a crate. Literally, that's all he had. But basketball is getting away from that. Travel teams, mm-hmm. AU teams. If you don't have these things, you know, if you're in a New Balance circuit, you can only wear New Balance, right? If you don't, it is changing economics, right?
Yeah.
That people bring it in. Baseball's already done it. Growing up, you hear baseball during this time. Even there was time period before. Baseball was what? You know, it was people outside that's playing stickball, right? You hear that mm-hmm. talk about all the time. Now you got to be traveling the country. You need a specific bat, specific glove, cleats. You need all these kind of things. So you need some more money. Back then, it is, if you're poor, there's a reason why all boxers were Latinos, Italians, and Blacks. There's a reason why that was the case. All of a sudden, in tennis and in golf, these country club sports, it was much less diverse.
Yep.
So when it comes to basketball at this time stamp and prior to this, not only is it a we're systematically knocking like keeping you out for racial reasons, it is we're keeping you in a box economically as well. And you know, this all is there is, and I can't wait to talk to the author about this, right?
Right.
Because it is like when you see Kaepernick kneel and you hear the rhetoric of politics don't belong in sports, what does she think? Because at any point, if certain people weren't allowed to play a sport, then politics was inherently involved. So what is that? So as an author who's making this book, because I'm checking, this book took her years, right? Years of research.
Mm-hmm.
So as that rhetoric is going around, what is her thought process? Like, I'm curious, because if you know things, if you're just aware of like the history of sports, you know that's a ridiculous statement. But like, is it exposure? Is it, yeah, all of that is what's going through my mind as I'm reading this book, especially in chapter 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. In our conversation just now opens up the perfect segue to talk about Spencer Haywood's situation. Spencer Haywood, you guys may know him sadly because of was the show the Lakers came out with on HBO? Well, not the Lakers, but
Showtime. HBO
Showtime. You may know him as the one who has some off the court issues. But before that, much like the rest of us, kid from the South who saw a way out of poverty in sports. One thing that I always find crazy about like Mississippi specifically is the level of talent that can come out of a place that we know was one of the poorest.
The poorest
state in our union, and is pretty big statewide. So we're just talking about like it being a piece of land,
yeah,
and yet so sparsely populated that it almost doesn't make sense. And yet we have three Olympians who all grow up together in the same town, and Wilma Rudolph, Spencer Haywood, and Spencer Haywood's girlfriend, who I'm sorry, I do not remember her name right now. I'll make sure to put it here in the edit. But the stuff that we learn about Spencer Haywood during this time and his struggle of all the stuff that he went through in college, and then all the stuff that he had to endure to even get paid for his services and his skills are absolutely insane. This is another pretty much what 5-year legal battle of him trying to figure out where he can actually make a living for him, he and his family, while also being called greedy, as if people don't know where he came from and the fact that he is doing this basically for legacy reasons and to move his family out of what?
Okay. So
mid-Jim Crow era?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to talk about this one a little bit. So, and this doesn't get into super heavy spoilers, but just so anyone, you know, listening to this is clear, something that is made clear in the book is that the ABA was basically just a bunch of rich dudes trying to get into the NBA. Playing rich the long game. Huh?
Rich lawyers specifically.
Well, it wasn't just lawyers, though. There was a dude who owned, like, a trucking company?
Yeah.
That came into play with Hawkins stuff, though, I think.
Yeah.
Right, rich dudes trying to get into the NBA. And one of the things with Haywood that comes into play, well, it's a couple things. One, right, he signs super young. And, you know, the contract is, to be polite about it, not good.
I thought you was going to go with garbage. I know it was on the tip of your tongue.
I was debating stronger language, but let me not. Right, but he didn't know that at the time he signed.
Yeah.
And right, we talk about the NBA as a business. The ABA was a business. The ABA was, you know, very much like a battle with the NBA for talent and the like. And they did a lot of creative stuff with their contracts to make them appear larger than they were in function, without getting into too many details, mostly because it's worth reading the book just to get a grasp on this nonsense. Side note, there's, for anybody wondering, a lot of legal maneuvering in the books, like it all makes sense. It's just fascinating. And what you will see with everything that we talk about here in the book is that it's not just a legal battle, it's also a battle for public opinion.
Mm.
Right? Public opinion in one of the more racially, well, in what is basically the era of, you know, civil rights and black power, depending on the exact date of stuff. And owners attempting and like but owners and players like attempting to win public opinion, and owners kind of getting it offhand from like sympathy from a lot of white publications, and wider areas just. Because black people shouldn't want to have things. I've been trying to tap dance around a lot of stuff.
Don't tap dance, bro. Break dance. Go.
Break dance.
To kind of give context during this, right? And in fairness, y'all were right earlier that the audience for the book are people who probably already have a lot of this context, even though it should I feel like it's kind of a book worth reading for anybody who's interested in like sports in particular and basketball, like sports in general, basketball in particular, and, you know, want a look at how much more lively the supposedly dead era of the league was than it was laid out to be. like the reality of the situation, right, is like during this time, right, which we have the civil rights movement and it's million and one moving parts, right? Martin and Malcolm, well, actually, by this point in the book, like by the point with a lot of stuff we're talking about, they both died. Well, they've both been murdered, assassinated, whatever you want to call it. And we're into Black Power and people like Huey Newton and Stokely Carmichael and the like, the Black Panthers becoming more prominent figures. And right, it's not like the, and like we like to, and while people often like to pretend as though, right, after the civil rights movement, it was all good, it was not all good. The racists didn't go anywhere. They just couldn't say this stuff as publicly anymore. And it didn't really stop them, if we're being real. But,
yeah, just because so you can't say stuff publicly doesn't mean your actions change.
Exactly. And these racial dynamics, as well as, like, a lot of politics dealing with workers' rights and whatever, which, side note, not directly related to this and probably won't come up into play during the book, Reagan is hot garbage. I will not be elaborating. That is all. But, but like, there's a lot of, like, it gets into a lot of politics dealing with workers' rights, but also just like how that plays in when we start, when the workers have brown faces.
Yeah.
Right. And how, like, you can see the, like, and, like, during that period, right, workers' rights were still kind of a, like, unions still had some sway back then.
Oh, right? they were fighting tooth and nail to make sure sports was not unionized.
Oh, that too, yes.
Also, but like, just side note, currently, if you're anti-union, I look at you differently. Like, as, like, a person.
Oh, yeah.
Like. Oh, and this book leads, it adds to that. I mean, business, in the way businesses ran, business code of ethics in a general sense, for it to gain the highest amount of profit, the people at bottom suffer. Period. Mm-hmm. I mean, right? That's like, capitalistic system, that's like what that is, right?
Yeah.
So without a union, that there is, you know, so without a union, it allows there to be no moral and ethic code for the system, right? Whatever that business is at that time. So you're talking about like NBA, ABA, and then we'll get into, or we'll get into this when we get to the Oscar Robertson stuff. Mm-hmm. But it is an individual or individuals in terms of unionization, knowing their worth and knowing what they bring to the table and what that does for the business itself, and wanting that to be acknowledged. That doesn't sound crazy to me, but if you got intense money in the game, you're only in this to gain more money, right? Like, sure. Nowadays, you have people like an owner that people like, right? Like Mark Cuban, right? People like Mark Cuban because of, you know, the Shark Tank and because of all these different things, right? Like personality. If he wasn't able to make money off the players, he would not be in the NBA business, period. I mean, it's a lot of things aren't that simple, but this right here is that simple, right? Businessman, make money, man. That's all that is. And you know, instead of selling iPhones, they're selling a product called basketball, who is played by actual individual players. And this right here is just kind of like, this is a synopsis of why all that is important, because it showcases why, it showcases the issues that came at hand before these things were allowed to be.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's see. Only other thing I would add, just to touch on the union thing, right, in the book. Basically, just to touch on real quick, the NBA's Player Association, as we know it to be now, didn't, like, I just like people to know, it didn't really come about until around, like, a little before this time period. Yeah. When, like, Black players became more and more common. And, you know, just the whole, because in the book, right, it mentions that early, the Players Association was really, I'm going to say lenient, for lack of better phrasing, with the owners. And, you know, at a certain point, particularly when they start getting more Black players, that began to change. For the better, particularly as far as the players are concerned. But, right, it's just worth noting that, you know, just having a union isn't enough if it's not doing anything for the people it is supposed to be representing.
But even sometimes it can go too far, aka cop unions, right? So like there are
cop levels. Unions should not exist.
Yes, but with that being said, though, right, there are levels to these things as well, and being able to understand and engage in the matters of situations at hand, and you just have to have a strong knowledge base of this. And if anybody wants, like, a foundational level of knowledge about how a union works, or the benefits, I guess, of a union prior and post-unionship, then, like, this book is a good indication for that.
Most definitely. And, guys, I need you to understand something. We are leaving a lot of meat on the bone when we're talking about this book because of how dense it is with information. We could literally have an episode just on the introduction. That's how much knowledge is dropped in less than 20 pages. Every single page is basically a 10-minute segment in itself. When we talked about Connie Hawkins, we did not talk about so much purposely for time reasons. When we talk about Spencer Haywood, we haven't even touched on the fact that his ruling that allowed him to play professional basketball after 3 years of college pretty much sets the table for the one and done rule.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that we have to kind of leave off. Is there anything else that you guys would like to say about this chapter before we move on to the Oscar Robertson?
I'm not even going to, like, try and add to the chapter stuff. I'm just, everybody, what you need to understand is some of what we're doing is walking around stuff or not talking about stuff directly to not spoil stuff for you. This is a really good book. It's worth you picking up and taking the time to read. And, like, also, again, like Alan said, we can't get to everything in a reasonable time. So, yeah. On to one of the NBA Players Association's leaders, Oscar Robertson.
Yeah. Hey, Oscar Robertson is one of the baddest human beings. Historically, he seems so nullified. And then when you see him in interviews today, he does not seem like the badass that he clearly was during his playing days. He seems like a jovial older dude who's just kind of like, yeah, this happened. Nah, bro, this dude got bars. I wrote in my notes, word for word, Oscar Robertson got that dog in him. Oh, yeah. I know it's very lame. I was driving when I wrote it, but that's what it is. He is a bad man, but to give a little bit more light, this is the chapter where we really get into the battle for unions and fighting for players' rights and their ability to make, one, a living wage, two, when you really, the players are being knowledgeable about what was happening in the past compared to now. And we also see a lot of the dirty business of business and how they hit a lot of their financial stuff. And as a person who has a business degree, when they started talking about the numbers, and we're like, there's a section of the book where they talk about how, I want to say for 67, and it's not consecutive seasons, this is like as a whole, of the 67 seasons that were played during the ABA's first, I want to say like 15 or so years, only 21 of those seasons for teams were profitable. And they did a little digging, found out they super fudged the numbers, and you see how grimy all of this stuff is. And this is where you really get a look. Well, you see it throughout this entire part of the book. But I feel like this is the crescendo where you see both sides of the media. I mean, black media and white media being like, y'all going too far. And all of the barbs that fall on these guys during this time. And the fact that they kept fighting for what they knew was right and what they would eventually use to set as a precedence is absolutely amazing.
Anybody that sits out because of money, never knock. Right? Like, that's one of the things I got from this chapter. Because you hear about all the time, right? In multiple sports, it is, I am not, so-and-so didn't show up to training camp because they're holding out for some kind of payment, so on and so forth, raise, whatever. And then you'll hear the rhetoric around that, depending on who the individual is, will either go one of two ways, right? It'll go it will either be pro player or pro organization, right? Me personally, always gonna be pro player.
Oh yeah.
But this and seeing what Oscar Robertson did early on, of like, no, you're not gonna make all that money off me and then me make pennies and cents in return. The numbers are drastically different now, but in the day, interest percentage, they're probably about the same, right? Okay. I mean, the advertisement and all the numbers, attendance, whatever, all these numbers that these NBA teams gain from all different avenues in comparison to what they're playing. Not everybody is getting these millions and millions and millions of dollars like LeBron or like Anthony Davis or like, you know, all these superstars, Steph Curry. There's a lot more non-Steph Currys than there are Steph Currys. Yeah. So individuals who are doing something to establish self-value in terms of the dollar, in terms of gaining, which I can also easily transition, which, once again, talk to the author, I'm going to transition this to college, right? And, you know, sure, NIL now, but that's still not enough, right?
It's not at all.
It's still not enough because...
And that only affects the 1%.
That is outside the university themselves need to be giving money. Like, that the NIL in many ways was a distraction from the universities being able to give money themselves. Because at the end of the day, once again, if you go to University of Kansas and sure, the jerseys don't have, you know, the names in the back, but if somebody's number 15 and they're getting buckets, then trust me, there's going to be a number 15 up there in that. There's going to be a number 15. It doesn't have his name on it, but we all know who number 15 is. You know what I mean? In that gift shop. So this is an easy transition into college sports and self-worth and what can that look like in the future and engaging in that whole dialogue as well. But in terms of Oscar Robertson and the groundbreaking landmarks that he set forth in this moment, once again, just to reiterate the point, anybody who sits out because I want more money from the organization, I am okay with that. Now, every reason to sit out is not the same. I'm specifically saying financially, right? I appreciate that because once again, it is self-value and market value for the player in comparison to the business of the organization.
Yeah, and I'm about to hit y'all in the chest to show y'all that it's not just about what the league was doing. This is a full economic issue. Teresa puts it very simply. At the same time where Oscar Robertson was being a bad man who averaged 30-point triple doubles, it took him 11 years of his career to get one endorsement deal, and it was for a razor. It took Pistol Pete Maravich one season to get a signature shoe.
Right. Okay. So, okay, how do I unpack this? One, yes, that gets it. The thing is, while that's economic, that also very much gets into race and things and money and advertising and all of that. But to give some context for the stuff we're talking around a little bit for the viewer. So what, okay. One, and I'm just going to put this here because there's not a clean way to put this. Oscar Robertson was not a fan of white people. Because like he remembered how they did him in like high school and stuff, like I think the first like all black team or something to, you know, get that high school, you know, title in basketball or whatever. They were treated awfully, and he basically held that the rest of his life. He might have mellowed out now, I don't know. But like he clearly carried that with him into the league too. So he's not going to have the patience. But also, right, so we mentioned how the ABA was basically just some rich dude's gambit to get basketball teams in the NBA. So when we get to Oscar Robertson, minor spoilers for events that happened like 50 years ago, that the ABA and the NBA had begun merger talks.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And this is in the book, to be just so everyone is clear. Right. The ABA and NBA begun merger talks. The players weren't a big fan of this for various reasons. Well, they had various grievances. One of them being that it was good for them that the ABA and the NBA were separate, because that means they had more places where they could play ball that could compete for their services.
Yeah.
Right, the merger would interfere with that, right? There were also concerns that with the ballooning, for some players, there's an issue, concern that with the increasing salaries of, right, these new incoming players, that right, older players would get pushed out because their salaries aren't as much to make room for these new kids. And Oscar was picked because he was a star player. They wanted somebody with some clout. The NBA and ABA were trying to merge trying to get a temporary antitrust exemption the same way that the NFL had done about half a decade earlier. Under that same thing that allowed the MLB to be, that continues to allow the MLB to be exempt from antitrust laws. No, I will not let this go. This is stupid. Oscar and the NBA Players Association, as well as, what was it, Beattie, I think, the president of the ABA's Players Association, right, they they were not fans. Like, they had no intention of just letting these things happen.
Yeah. And I need y'all to, another thing to hit you in the chest with. It wasn't just black players that had an issue with the ABA merger. Because Oscar Robertson was the face of it, it became specifically a black issue. But you had dudes like Dave DeBuscher, who I now understand why they value this human being as a great basketball player. He was also a part of the movement that were kind of for players that was like, we don't want this to happen because this will have a negative impact on our earning potential. So this was a unified effort. It wasn't just black people trying to grab for more money. Like, this is an economic game at the end of the day. All of it is. I want to bring that home for y'all.
And the thing too, right? I think in the book, they did some kind of, I don't remember exactly. It was like a petition or something.
Yeah.
That every player in the association unanimously signed for, except one, who I think the book said was theorized to be like Hawkins or something, because supposedly it was in his contract that he wouldn't sue the league again. Like, they were completely united on this stuff.
That is a wild clause in the NBA contract. I honestly think as a player, I don't know if I would let that slide. Yeah. So, do you guys have anything else that you would like to touch on for chapter 3?
I personally do not. The first three chapters in a general sense just made me excited to engage with Teresa herself. And kind of like dig deeper into the thought process behind motivations, all kinds of stuff behind the book, because I think a book like this is needed in terms of like the knowledge base. But once again, to go back to the beginning of the conversation, I do wonder who this book's for. The audience that she hopes really engages with this book, who is that? And I'm curious what her thoughts on that.
Also, guys, especially dudes on this podcast, if you do have questions, Teresa is active on Twitter, and I believe her DMs are open. So stop being like that. Be an adult.
this is why you refer to people as professor or like doctor, so that we don't run into these kinds of issues, sir.
We're adults.
Professor.
We don't know what we're here for. But
you know what?
From now on, refer to me as Professor Dixon. Thank you. Continue.
No. guys, again, this is just part one of hopefully a four-part series. We're going to do part two coming soon. Part three, and then we would like to have Professor Teresa Runstetter on the podcast. We'll definitely make sure we're getting everything figured out how she would like to be
addressed.
Yes, thank you. but again, stay tuned. This is going to be a great read. Probably won't be on bookshelves in Florida, but that's besides the point. We won't get into that. But thank you guys so much for tuning in to this special episode of the Traveling Hoopers podcast. I have been your host, Alan Pettigrew Jr., and my friends in front of me will sign us out.
Once again, right? Pleasure, everybody. I'm Calvin McGowan. Thank you for joining us for another episode, for this special episode of the Traveling Hoopers podcast. Write, like, share, subscribe, with something in the comments. You can listen to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And this, it's just a really good book. Like, just, yeah.
Yep, and my name is Philip Dixon. Thank you all for joining us this, like I mentioned, this special edition of Traveling Hoopers Podcast. Keep on listening to us, and hopefully you'll gain as much knowledge as we're gaining currently.
Yeah, and buy that joint when it comes out March 7th.